The incessant beeping of the alarm jolted me awake, the same cruel reminder of my daily drudgery. I stared at the ceiling, the fan casting shadows that danced mockingly over my head. Another day in hell, another day as a customer service agent for a bank. As I dragged myself out of bed, I felt the familiar weight of dread settle in my chest, a constant companion since I started this job. I wasn't always like this. There was a time when I believed in the mantra, "The customer is always right." But that was before I worked here, before I became the target of their frustrations and anger. My previous job, one that required minimal contact with people, was a distant, almost pleasant memory. I had to leave it for academic reasons, but now, with time on my hands, I found myself shackled to this modern-day slavery. The day started like any other. I sat in my cubicle, the hum of computers and murmurs of my colleagues forming a monotonous backdrop. I logged into the system, my fingers moving mechanically over the keyboard. The calls started pouring in almost immediately.
"Thank you for calling First National Bank. How can I assist you today?"
My voice, trained to sound cheerful, felt like a mask I wore to hide my true feelings.
"Where the hell is my money?"
The voice on the other end was sharp, accusatory. I pulled up the account details, scanning through the transactions.
"I see here that the transaction is pending, sir. It should clear by the end of the day."
"That's not good enough! I need it now!" he barked.
"I'm sorry, sir, but the system processes transactions."
"I don't give a damn about your system! Fix it!"
I took a deep breath, forcing myself to remain calm.
"Sir, I didn't create the system. I'm just here to assist you."
"Assist? You're useless!"
He hung up, leaving a ringing silence in my ears. I leaned back in my chair, my hands trembling with suppressed anger. It wasn't the first time a customer had lashed out at me, and it wouldn't be the last. But each insult, each accusation, chipped away at my patience and sanity. By midday, I was exhausted. The calls were relentless, each one a new assault on my frayed nerves. I thought about the warning I received last week for quote-unquote bad attitude after telling a customer I didn't create the system. They expected us to be punching bags, absorbing all the vitriol without complaint. As the day wore on, my depression deepened. I felt trapped, suffocated by the walls of the cubicle and the endless stream of complaints. The anger simmered just beneath the surface, a dangerous beast I struggled to keep caged. That evening, after another grueling shift, I found myself at a bar. The dim lighting and soft music provided a temporary escape from my reality. I ordered a drink, the first of many, hoping to drown the memories of the day. "Rough day?" the bartender asked, placing my drink in front of me. "You have no idea," I muttered, taking a long sip. He nodded sympathetically. "Customer service, huh?" "Yeah, how'd you guess?" "Seen that look before," he said with a wry smile. "Hang in there." I downed my drink and ordered another. As the alcohol began to numb my senses, I felt a strange mix of anger and desire bubbling up. I wanted to forget, to escape the misery, if only for a few hours. My eyes scanned the room, landing on a woman on the other end of the bar. She was beautiful, in a way that seemed almost ethereal in the low light. I approached her, my steps unsteady. "Can I buy you a drink?" I asked, trying to sound confident. She looked up, her eyes meeting mine. There was something in her gaze, something dark and knowing. "Sure," she said, a small smile playing on her lips. We talked, the conversation flowing easily despite my inebriated state. There was an intensity between us, a connection that felt electric. We left the bar together, the night air cool against my flushed skin. Back at my apartment, the passion between us was raw, almost primal. But as the night wore on, that darkness I saw in her eyes began to seep into my thoughts. She spoke of things that unsettled me, her words weaving a narrative of power and control.
"You ever feel like you want to hurt them?"
she whispered, her breath hot against my ear. I pulled away, staring at her in confusion.
"What?" "The customers. The ones who make your life hell."
A shiver ran down my spine.
I don't know.
She smiled, a cruel, knowing smile.
"It's natural to feel that way. You're only human."
The rest of the night was a blur. I woke up alone, the memories of our conversation haunting me. Her words had planted a seed of doubt, a dangerous thought that began to grow. The next day, at work, I couldn't shake the feeling. Every angry customer, every insult, fueled the dark thoughts swirling in my mind. I found myself fantasizing about revenge, about making them feel the pain they inflicted on me. It scared me how easily those thoughts came. Weeks passed, and the darkness grew. I started isolating myself, avoiding friends and family. The only relief came from my nightly visits to the bar, where I sought out that woman again and again. She became my confidant, my dark muse. One night, as we lay in bed, she looked at me with those piercing eyes.
"You know what you have to do," she said softly.
I nodded, the weight of her words settling heavily on my shoulders. I knew what she meant, what she was pushing me towards.
But could I do it? Could I cross that line?
The next day, a particularly irate customer pushed me to my breaking point. He was yelling, his face red with anger.
"You're useless! I want to speak to your manager!"
Something snapped inside me. I stood up, my chair toppling over.
"I've had enough!"
I shouted, slamming my headset down. The office fell silent, all eyes on me. My manager approached, her face a mix of concern and anger.
"Step into my office," she said, her voice tight.
I followed her, my heart pounding. She closed the door behind us, turning to face me.
"What's going on? This isn't like you."
I took a deep breath, the weight of the past months crashing down on me.
"I can't do this anymore. The abuse, the constant pressure, it's destroying me."
She sighed, her expression softening.
"I know it's hard, but you can't let it get to you. We all go through it."
"Do we?"
I asked, my voice breaking.
"Do you know what it's like to be blamed for things you have no control over, day in and day out?"
She looked away, a flicker of guilt crossing her face.
"Maybe not, but we have to remain professional. It's our job."
"I can't,"
I whispered.
"I can't do this anymore."
She nodded slowly. "Take some time off. Think about what you want. We can discuss your options when you're ready." I left her office, the weight of my shoulders feeling slightly lighter. I knew I needed to make a change, to find a way out of the darkness that had consumed me. I spent the next few weeks reflecting on my life, my choices. I cut ties with the woman from the bar, realizing the toxic influence she had over me. I reached out to friends and family, rebuilding the connections I had neglected. Slowly, the anger and depression began to lift. I found a new job, one that allowed me to work with people in a more positive way. It wasn't easy, but I learned to cope with the challenges, to find healthier ways to deal with my emotions. The experience left its mark on me, a reminder of how close I came to losing myself. But it also taught me the importance of self-care, of setting boundaries and seeking help when needed. In the end, I found peace. I learned to let go of the anger and embrace the things that brought me joy. And for the first time in a long time, I felt hope for the future. I wasn't even sure why I locked the door. I mean, who locks themselves in their own room just to play a game? But I guess it wasn't about the game. It was about the time I was buying, trying to forget for a few more moments. You see, when you lose someone, like I lost my dad, you cling to distractions. And that night, my distraction was a round of Warzone. "Dinner's ready," my dad had called. I could hear his voice echoing in my head. "I'll be down after this match," I yelled back, more out of habit than anything else. It had been years since that last dinner call, but it felt as real as it had the night before the accident. He said, "Okay." But I knew better. He never waited for me to finish anything. Still, the urge to obey was there, nagging at me, pulling me out of the game and down to the kitchen where a plate of food, now cold and untouched, was likely waiting for me. But I wasn't hungry. Hell, I hadn't been hungry in days, not since the nightmares started again. So I went back to my game. The sounds of gunfire and explosions filled my headphones, drowning out everything else. I was in the zone, fingers moving fast across the controller, my character taking down enemies one by one. The adrenaline was a welcome replacement for the anxiety gnawing at the edges of my mind. Then came the second call. "Your food is getting cold!" My dad's voice came again, this time sharper, more urgent. My heart sank. This wasn't real, I knew that, but the panic set in anyway. I started praying, my lips moving silently. I just needed to finish this game. Just needed a few more minutes to get my head together. "He died 8 years ago," I whispered to myself, like a mantra, trying to shake off the chill that crept up my spine. But the voice had been so clear, so commanding, like he was standing right there in the room with me. I didn't know why I did it, but I grabbed my phone and dialed 911. My voice was trembling as I spoke. I think someone's in my house," I stammered. "It's my dad, but he's been dead for years. I don't know what's going on. Please send someone." There was a pause on the other end of the line. Then the operator's voice, calm and professional. "We're sending a unit now. Stay on the line with me." "No," I blurted out. "Just hurry, please." I hung up before she could say anything else. 3 minutes later, I heard a knock on my door. Not the front door, but the one to my room. My breath caught in my throat. "Come on out, it's the police," a voice called from the other side. Something was wrong. My stomach twisted in knots as I realized I hadn't asked for a badge number. My dad had always told me to ask for a badge number. My dad. "No," I muttered, backing away from the door. "No, this isn't right." I quickly locked the door again, just as the banging started. "Open up!" the voice shouted, louder now, more forceful. My hands were shaking so badly, I dropped my phone. The pounding on the door grew more intense, almost desperate. I heard the sirens moments later, blaring in the distance, growing louder as they approached. Relief washed over me. Real cops were on their way. I just had to hold out a little longer. Then came the footsteps, heavy and deliberate, moving down the stairs. There was a moment of quiet, followed by gunshots, loud, sharp, and unmistakable. My heart pounded in my chest as I heard screams, agonizing and primal, filling the house with a sound that would be etched into my memory forever. And then, silence. The house was eerily silent, the kind of silence that presses in on you, suffocating, making it hard to breathe. I didn't move. I couldn't. My mind was racing, trying to make sense of what had just happened. No voices, no footsteps, nothing. I slowly crept towards the door, pressing my ear against it, straining to hear something, anything. But there was only silence. I knew I couldn't stay locked in my room forever. With shaking hands, I unlocked the door and slowly turned the knob. The door creaked open, revealing the hallway bathed in an unnatural stillness. I stepped out, my footsteps soft on the carpet. The house was dark, shadows stretching long and ominous. I made my way downstairs, each step echoing in the silence. When I reached the bottom, I saw the front door wide open, a cold breeze blowing in. There were no police cars outside, no sign of the chaos I'd heard moments ago. I walked to the door, my mind struggling to comprehend what I was seeing. Then I noticed something on the floor just inside the doorway, a crumpled piece of paper, stained and torn. I picked it up, my hands trembling. The writing was smudged, but I could still make out the words. "See you soon, son. Dinner's getting cold." The paper slipped from my fingers, fluttering to the floor. I backed away, the cold seeping into my bones, the reality of the situation crashing down on me. I never should have opened the door. It started as just another lazy Sunday afternoon. I was sitting on the sofa, mindlessly scrolling through my phone, half watching some old sitcom rerun. The summer heat had made the air thick and sticky, making even the simplest tasks feel like a chore. I wasn't interested in doing much, so I found myself staring up at the ceiling, where a couple of flies buzzed around the hanging light. At first, it was just a distraction. Something to occupy my mind as I avoided thinking about the stack of bills on the coffee table, or the fact that I had work the next morning. But then I noticed something strange. The flies weren't just buzzing randomly. They were moving in a pattern, a slow, deliberate circle around the light. The more I watched, the more captivated I became. The ceiling fans spun lazily overhead, barely stirring the warm air, but the flies seemed unaffected. They continued their circling dance, and I found myself unable to look away. My phone slipped from my hand, landing on the floor with a dull thud, but I didn't care. My eyes were glued to those flies, tracing their every movement. I don't know how long I laid there watching them. Time seemed to stretch, the minutes blending into hours. I felt an odd sense of calm, as if nothing outside of that circling pattern mattered. The bills, the job, the lingering loneliness, all of it faded away. There was just the light and the flies and the rhythm of their flight. And then, in a blink, I was in the kitchen. I blinked again, confused. I didn't remember getting up, didn't remember walking here. One moment I was on the sofa, and the next, I was standing in the middle of the kitchen, staring blankly at the refrigerator door. The cool tile floor sent a shiver through me, waking me up from whatever trance I had been in. "What the hell?" I muttered to myself, shaking my head as if that would clear the fog from my mind. But the confusion didn't fade. Instead, it deepened as I noticed the flies again, now circling the light above the kitchen island. It was the same pattern, the same hypnotic rhythm. And before I knew it, I was staring at them again. My mind went blank. And the next thing I knew, I was outside in the garden. I was barefoot, the grass cool and damp beneath my feet. The sun was setting, casting long shadows across the yard. But I didn't care about any of that. All I could focus on were the flies. Dozens of them now, maybe more. They moved in intricate patterns, swirling through the air like they were drawing something, some shape I couldn't quite make out. I didn't know how I got there, didn't know why I was standing barefoot in the garden with the sky turning dark above me, but I couldn't look away from the flies. I felt like I was being pulled into their dance, my mind sinking deeper into that soothing rhythm. But as I watched, something changed. The flies' pattern began to shift, their movement growing erratic. The shapes they formed became more complex, almost sinister. My heart began to race, a creeping sense of dread inching up my spine, but still I couldn't tear my eyes away. Suddenly, I was in my bedroom. The sudden shift was jarring, like waking from a nightmare only to find yourself still trapped in it. I was sitting on the edge of my bed, the sheets rumpled beneath me. My pulse pounded in my ears, and for the first time, I realized just how wrong this all was. I jumped to my feet, trying to shake off the feeling, but then I saw them again, the flies. They were in my room now, circling the lamp on my nightstand. My breath caught in my throat as I watched them. I knew I should run, knew I should get out of the house, but I couldn't move. Something clicked in my mind, and I remembered a news story I had seen a few weeks back. People in town had been going missing, vanishing without a trace. They'd been hypnotized, some said, drawn into the woods by something they couldn't resist. The police had no leads, no suspects, only a handful of witnesses who spoke of strange patterns in the air, of being unable to look away. As the realization hit me, the flies' pattern shifted again. The shape they were forming became clear, a spiral, pulling tighter and tighter. And at the center of that spiral, I saw something I hadn't noticed before. A dark, shifting figure. Barely more than a shadow, but there nonetheless. I stumbled back, fear crashing over me like a wave. I knew then that if I kept staring, if I let that spiral pull me in, I would disappear just like the others. But I couldn't look away. The pull was too strong.
No,
I whispered, forcing the word out.
This isn't real.
The shadow figure seemed to grow darker, the spiral tighter. My vision blurred, but I kept fighting, kept telling myself it wasn't real, that it was all in my head. And then, with a final burst of strength, I broke free. I slammed my eyes shut and stumbled backward, crashing into the dresser. The sound jarred me, snapping me out of the trance. When I opened my eyes again, the flies were gone. The room was empty, silent, save for my ragged breathing. I collapsed onto the bed, my body trembling. I was safe. Whatever had happened, whatever those flies were, I had broken free. In the days that followed, I couldn't stop thinking about it. About how close I had come to losing myself. But as the memory of that night faded, replaced by the mundane worries of daily life, I realized something. The flies weren't the real danger. It was my own mind, the way it had latched onto the pattern that had almost done me in. I threw myself into work, into reconnecting with friends, anything to keep my mind occupied. And slowly, the fear faded. Life went on, and I was still here to live it. But every now and then, when the house is quiet and the light catches just right, I swear I can hear the faint buzz of flies. And I remind myself, never again. It was one of those nights where the air felt heavy, thick with something intangible yet unsettling. The kind of night where silence hung like a weight, and every rustle of the wind sent a shiver down your spine. We had always been the adventurous type, my friends and I, but something about this night was different. It wasn't just the darkness, or the fact that we were deep in the woods, miles away from any semblance of civilization. It was something else. Something I couldn't quite put my finger on. But that didn't stop us. Nothing ever did. The village we lived in was more of a ghost town than anything else. Most houses were abandoned, relics from a time long gone, almost a century old. Exploring them had become our obsession, our way of shaking off the boredom of small town life. There was me, always the cautious one, Jason, who was brave to the point of recklessness, Megan, my best friend since kindergarten, who always had something to prove, and Sarah, the quiet observer with a knack for sensing things the rest of us couldn't.
We'd been hearing rumors about a particular house hidden deep in the forest that bordered our town. The locals called it the Widow's House, claiming it had been abandoned for nearly a century, its last inhabitant a woman who vanished without a trace. They said the house was cursed, that anyone who ventured too close would never return the same. Naturally, we had to check it out. The house stood eerily still when we found it, a looming shadow in the dark, its windows like empty eyes staring into the void. The moonlight barely reached it through the thick canopy of trees, casting long, twisted shadows that made the whole place look like something out of a nightmare. "Looks like it's still standing," Jason muttered as we approached. The door was jammed shut, but we were used to that. With some effort, we climbed through a cracked window, landing in a dank, musty room. The air was thick with the stench of rot, like old meat left to spoil. Giant bugs skittered across the floor, making the hairs on my neck stand on end. I wanted to leave right then, but Megan nudged me forward. We split up to cover more ground. Jason and Sarah took the stairs to the second floor, while Megan and I stayed on the first. The house creaked and groaned under our weight, as though it resented our presence. Every step felt like an intrusion, every breath an offense to whatever had been left behind. Suddenly, a blood-curdling scream tore through the night, freezing us in our tracks. It wasn't coming from the house, but from the forest, somewhere beyond the dark path that led into the depths of the trees. We rushed outside, the house forgotten in an instant. The path into the forest was a black void, impossible to see through, even with the light of our phones. "I'm going to check it out," Megan declared, her voice resolute. Her eyes gleamed with that familiar determination, the need to prove she wasn't afraid, that she was braver than the rest of us. Jason and Sarah hesitated, their faces pale. I tried to convince her to stay, to wait for daylight, or for us to go together. But Megan was stubborn, calling us cowards before disappearing into the inky darkness. Minutes felt like hours as we stood there, listening to the silence that followed. Then, another scream, this one unmistakably Megan's, pierced the night. Without thinking, we plunged into the forest, our fear forgotten as panic set in. We searched for what felt like hours, calling her name, shining our lights into every shadow, but Megan was nowhere to be found. Eventually, we had to face the truth. She was gone. The police searched the forest and the surrounding areas for weeks. They found nothing. No tracks, no sign of struggle, nothing. Megan had simply vanished, as if the forest had swallowed her whole. The town was in shock. But life went on, as it always does.
As I stared at the message on my phone, my heart pounded so hard I thought it might burst out of my chest. I felt the room spinning around me, my vision blurring with tears of betrayal. The words, clear and brutal, etched into my mind. I can't get over her. She's my favorite person to talk to. This wasn't just any post. It was a confession from my boyfriend about his feelings for another woman. The woman he'd known longer than he'd known me. The woman who lived far away, and yet somehow had taken a hold of his heart. 3 years, almost four, gone in an instant. I had poured everything into this relationship, sacrificing my time, my money, and my sanity to keep him happy. He didn't have a job. His family treated him horribly. My parents, especially my mom, understood and supported our relationship, even when I had to foot the bill for our dates. My dad, although reluctant, wanted me to be happy. And now, all that effort seemed like a waste. His heart apparently belonged to someone else. I knew I had to comfort him, but anger boiled inside me. I wanted to lash out, to make him feel the pain he caused me, but I had to be smart about this. I had to know more. "Hey, babe," I said, trying to keep my voice steady as I walked into the living room where he was lounging on the couch. His phone was on the coffee table, and I could see him tense up as I approached. "Hey," he replied, glancing at me with those eyes that once were filled with love. Now all I saw was deceit. "Can I borrow your phone for a second? Mine's dead. I need to check something." I made my request sound casual, but inside my heart was racing. He hesitated, and that hesitation told me everything I needed to know. Sure, just give me a minute." He reached for his phone, and I saw him quickly swipe and tap, undoubtedly deleting evidence of his infidelity. "No need, I'll just charge mine," I said, masking my frustration with a smile. "Want some coffee?" He relaxed, not suspecting a thing. Sure, thanks. As I poured the coffee, I formulated a plan. If he thought he could hide things from me, he was wrong. I had my way of finding out the truth. That night, while he slept, I went through his phone. He had indeed deleted most of their chat history, but I found enough to confirm my worst fears. Messages filled with heart emojis, confessions, and how he missed her, how she was perfect. The anger inside of me festered into something darker. I felt like I was losing control, my emotions teetering on the edge of the precipice. I couldn't just confront him. No, that would be too easy. I needed him to feel the weight of his betrayal. I needed to turn his life into a nightmare. The next day, I decided to play it cool. "You know, I've been thinking," I said over breakfast. "We should go on a little trip, just the two of us, somewhere we can reconnect." His eyes lit up, and I almost felt sorry for him. Almost. "That sounds great. Where do you want to go?" "How about a cabin in the woods? Just us, nature, no distractions." He agreed, and I could see that he was excited. Little did he know that this trip would be unlike any other. I rented a remote cabin far away from prying eyes, the perfect place for what I had in mind. We drove there, and he chatted happily, oblivious to the storm brewing inside me. Once we arrived, I pretended everything was fine, laughing and enjoying our time together. On the second night after dinner, I suggested we go for a walk. "It's so beautiful out here. Let's enjoy the night air." He agreed, and we ventured into the woods. The moonlight cast eerie shadows, but I felt strangely calm. This was it, the moment I was waiting for. As we walked deeper into the forest, I stopped. "I need to tell you something," I said, my voice trembling with a mixture of fear and excitement. He turned to me, concern etched on his face. "What is it?" "I know about her. I know you love her," I said, my voice starting to break. "I've seen the messages." His face paled. "It's not what you think." "Don't lie to me," I screamed, my voice echoing through the trees. "I've given you everything, and this is how you repay me?" "I'm sorry," he whispered, tears streaming down his face. "I didn't mean to hurt you." "Sorry isn't enough," I said, my voice cold and detached. "You need to understand what it feels like to be betrayed." Before he could react, I pulled out a small knife I had hidden in my jacket. His eyes widened in fear as I approached him. "Please, don't!" But I didn't listen. I was beyond reasoning, beyond mercy. I slashed at him, and he stumbled back, clutching his wound. Blood seeped through his fingers, and he fell to the ground, gasping for breath. "I loved you," I said, tears streaming down my face. "I loved you so much, and you threw it all away." As he laid there, struggling to breathe, I felt a twisted sense of satisfaction. He had to pay for his betrayal. I watched as the life slowly drained from his eyes, feeling the dark pleasure from his suffering. When it was over, I buried him in the woods, covering my tracks meticulously. No one would find him out here. It would be like he vanished into thin air. The deed was done, and now I could move on. Weeks passed, and no one suspected a thing. I played the grieving girlfriend, worried about her missing boyfriend. The police searched but found no leads. It was the perfect crime. But guilt has a way of creeping up on you. At night, I would hear his voice, see his face in my dreams. The weight of what I had done bore down on me, and I began to unravel. I drank to numb the pain, but it only made things worse. One night, I sat alone in my apartment, drowning in my sorrows, and there was a knock at my door. I opened it to find a police officer standing there. "Ma'am, I need to ask you some questions about your boyfriend's disappearance," he said. My heart raced, but I kept my composure. "Of course, officer. Anything to help find him." He stepped inside, and as he did, I saw a figure in the shadows. It was her, the woman that he had loved. She looked at me with a knowing smile. "Hello, old friend," she said. "I think we need to talk."
My best friend Sandy was having a birthday party at a warehouse just outside the city. It was this big brick building that was kind of famous in our area for secret raves and concerts and stuff. The place should honestly be condemned, but somehow the city just lets it sit there. Sandy thought it would be the perfect place for her party, but I wasn't so sure. I tried to tell her that I didn't feel comfortable going to a place like that. She got upset, and we started arguing about it. Before I knew it, she told me that I was a crappy friend and that I shouldn't even bother going to her party. I said, "Fine, then I won't go." So on the night of her party, I went by myself to a bar in the city center. I didn't have a great time, honestly. I kind of just sat by myself and rejected the guys that tried to introduce themselves. I knew I should have just swallowed my pride and gone to Sandy's party, but I didn't. By about 1 in the morning, I decided to just give up and head back home. I had been trying to have fun without Sandy, and it just wasn't working. I ordered an Uber and then waited outside the bar. After a few minutes, a black Nissan pulled up in front of me. Normally, I check my phone to make sure that the license plate matches, but I was pretty drunk, so I forgot. I hopped into the back seat and said hello to the driver. He was an older man with long, greasy hair. He had a scar on the tip of his nose. He didn't say hello before he started driving away. He pulled onto the main street and seemed to be going in the right direction, but then he made a wrong turn. "Excuse me," I said. "We're heading toward Hancock Road." "Oh," he said. "I'm so sorry. Can I see your phone for a second?" Without thinking, I handed him my phone and instantly threw it out the window. He sped up, too. The car was going faster and faster. That's when I realized that I wasn't in my Uber at all. I'd gotten into some stranger's car and he was kidnapping me. I screamed for him to stop, but he just laughed. I couldn't attack him from behind because he crashed the car. Besides, I was too drunk to think straight. The only thing I could do was try to convince him to let me go. "Please," I said. "Where are you taking me?" He stopped laughing. I could see his face in the rearview mirror. His eyes narrowed. "Girls like you don't deserve to live," he muttered. By then, I started crying. If I had just apologized to Sandy, I never would have been in this situation. I felt like such an idiot, and now God knows where the psycho was taking me. He kept driving, leaving the city center completely. We were heading into wide-open farmland. I was so scared, I couldn't breathe. We drove past empty fields. The night was really dark, especially with no streetlights nearby. I'd never been more scared in my life. I looked around the back seat to see if there was anything I could use to protect myself. I couldn't find anything. The lights of the city were getting fainter and fainter in the distance, and I was losing all hope. What did this man want with me? Why did he hate me so much? I forced myself to stop asking those questions, though. Sure, I'd made mistakes. I drank too much and got in the wrong car, but that didn't give him the right to kidnap me. Then I realized that the warehouse was in this direction. Obviously, this man was trying to take me to some empty, isolated place, but he had no idea that all my friends were actually not far away. I knew that if I had any chance of escaping, I'd need to trick this man into taking me to that warehouse. I tried to think of the best thing to say. "Please, sir," I said, "what can I do to convince you to let me go?" "Nothing," he said. You're a drunk, stupid girl. You deserve to be punished. So you're gonna kill me? He laughed darkly. I'm gonna tie you up and leave you where no one will ever find you. Oh no, I said. I hope you don't mean that horrible warehouse. He didn't answer. All I could hear were his slow, raspy breaths. You know, that big brick warehouse just a few minutes away? Please don't leave me there. No one will ever find me. Please, just leave me in a field or something. Again, he didn't answer. But I could tell that my reverse psychology was about to pay off. He drove straight toward the abandoned building and parked in the front. Luckily, Sandy told all her guests to park in the back so the cops wouldn't know that a party was going on. The place looked completely empty. Its thick walls muffled the party music that was playing inside. I could barely hear it, but I hoped that the driver wouldn't notice. Thankfully, he didn't. The driver stepped out of the car and then pulled my door open. He grabbed me by the wrist and yanked me out of the car. I didn't know who he was or what trauma from his past would lead him to kidnap a stranger, but I guess none of that mattered. All that mattered was that he was very dangerous. I didn't fight back. While holding me by the wrist, he opened his trunk and grabbed a backpack. It probably had duct tape and rope and stuff. Maybe there were weapons in there too. He slammed the trunk shut and then pulled me toward the warehouse. Please! I screamed, pretending to be as scared as possible. Not here! Anywhere else but here! He was squeezing my wrist hard enough to leave bruises. He looked at me triumphantly. This'll teach you a lesson, he said, and he pushed the front door open. You will not believe the look on his face when he saw the dozens of partiers on the other side. They all turned to look at us. Help me! I screamed, and of course everyone there came to my rescue. I couldn't believe how quickly they charged at the man. They tackled him to the ground and called the police. He put up a fight, but all my friends were too much for him. They held him against the ground, waiting for the cops to arrive. As I finally let out a sigh of relief, Sandy walked up to me. I noticed that she was wearing the dress I'd gotten her for her birthday last year. She gave me a huge hug. What the hell happened to you? She asked. I told her the whole story, ending with a big apology for our argument. Don't worry about it, she said. I guess my party saved your life.